with you. Not anything at all. I'd call
appreciate
it indie
it.
Advertising. I appreciate it. Mm. Thank you so much. When you
Can I
advertise,
give one tip?
Go for it. One tip.
Yeah. I want to say one thing. I think the reason that it's important is that it's a little bit different than it used to be, and that it's targeting children in a little bit different way. There's a lot of safeguards against, you know, like children's programming controlled, like TV stuff about, like, SpongeBob can't advocate for stuff, but there's this whole other genre of things that can happen that kids don't necessarily have the safeguards, the rationale as far as you can even attribute that to this, to sort of safeguard against that.
Oh, thank you for that, Althea. That's why we are just salt and honey, or I don't know if they'll go together.
What?
You know, that famous hip-hop duo from the early 90s. Salt and Honey.
Sonia, do you have one?
DJ Skinderella?
Like 2 seconds.
2 seconds.
Nope.
Oh, no time.
All right.
This has been The Gap. I'm Tammy. On the line with me is my better half, Althea, co-host and best friend forever.
Hey.
Hey,
which one
we
of
did
us
it.
Is salt and which one of us is honey?
We'll talk about that next week.
True.
Thank you for tuning in to The Gap. It's been a pleasure. Have a great weekend and enjoy your Friday. Happy Hanukkah,
bye.
Everyone.
Happy Hanukkah.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Help KBOO reach our Give Guide fundraising goal by December 31st. We're trying to meet our goal of raising $50,000, so show your support for KBOO today. Go to kboo.fm/give and show your support for volunteer-powered, community-driven radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, Director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that takes the history out of the oldest and largest collections of public radio programming in the United States and puts it back on the radio. This week, we present part one of a three-part series called Coal Country Women, which documented the lives of Appalachian women in the 1970s as wives and mothers of miners, as miners themselves, and on life in mining country.
Say, did you see him going?
It never occurred to me at all that Sack would have been hurt in that mine. My brother was in there, and Jimmy was in there, and I just, all kinds of friends were in the mines. You know, I felt like everyone I knew would be all right because Sack was in there. He would not have let anything happen. Or if it did, you know, he'd bring them out and they'd be all right. I just never thought about him being hurt.
This 1976 documentary is part of a collection called American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982, which is a collection of over 2,000 recordings from that era on the women's movement that had been preserved and made accessible to the public at large, thanks to a grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives. For more information about this collection, go to pacificaradioarchives.org. And now, we present part one, An Ordinary Morning, which tells the story of the aftermath of a mining disaster. This episode documents the personal impact of the Scotia mine disaster as felt by women whose husbands and sons were killed in the explosions at the Scotia mine in Oven Fork, Kentucky in March 1976. Now we present Coal Country Women, part one, on From the Vault.
David did not die. David was killed. And Rosha killed David.
It was as though, you know, Roy was a great guy while he was alive, but, you know, it happened. He was no longer there, so, you know, face that and forget it.
We all decide, well, we're going to sue somebody. You know, we want to find out what happened. And Gerald came down and talked to us about it. He said, ladies, I don't think you have a chance. You can't sue Russia Coal Company, you know. And I said, well, why not?
You were supposed to take what you could get and stay home and be a nice little widow. It was as though, you know, it's happened. We can't change that. So stop making waves.
Did you see him going? It was early this morning. He passed by these houses on his way to the coal.
It's such a simple thing, but you no longer have a reason to cook dinner. There's no timetable to meet. There's no home to build. You suddenly become an outsider in everything. You're no longer Roy's wife. You're one of the Scotia widows, which is what we became. And
the women remember that it began as just an ordinary morning. Geraldine McKnight hardly gave a thought to her daily routine as she fed the children and sent her husband Roy off to work in the cold gray dawn. The date was March 9th, 1976. Shortly before noon that day, an explosion ripped through Scotia Coal Company's Bottom Seam Mine near Oven Fork, Kentucky. A chance spark had ignited a pocket of methane gas deep under Black Mountain.
You know, you have no comprehension of how terrible an explosion inside the mines is, the force. You know, you think of an explosion, you think of, you know, maybe 4th of July fireworks or something like that. You know, you may get some force from it, but, you know, there's no way of understanding the force behind what that explosion was. And I asked him, I said, you know, what, does he have a chance? And he says, Geraldine, if he went where he was supposed to go, the explosion came from there, and said he doesn't have a chance.
Roy McKnight was one of 15 miners killed by the explosion. David Gibbs was another. The families of the miners heard of the accident by chance as they listened to the radio or waited in the checkout line at the grocery store. Libby Gibbs remembers a phone call.
I was home as usual. My sister called me and said, there's ambulance, you know, going up the road. Meet me and I will pick you up. So we went on up, and when we got to the mines, we seen everybody there. So, you know, so I went over and asked questions, you know, was David in, or where was David? Nobody knew. So I went and got my kids and to a friend's house and told her to keep them till I came back.
So I drove on up to Scotia, and when I got there, you know, there was cars everywhere. There wasn't any place to park. The Letcher County Sheriff's Department was out, you know, moving the traffic on. And I told him who I was and that I thought my husband was in there, and he said, is it one of the McKnights? He says, which one of the McKnights are you married to? And I told him Big Sack, which, you know, no one knew him by Roy. If they knew it, they never used his name. He was called Big Sack from his football days. He was he was a little over 6'7", and you know, he was just a huge man.
Or what can I say to my heart that's clear broken? To my heart that's clear broken, if my darling is gone. Say, did you see him going?
It never occurred to me at all that Sack would have been hurt in that mine. My brother was in there, and Jimmy was in there, and I just, all kinds of friends were in the mines, but I never, you know, I felt like everyone I knew would be all right because Sack was in there. And, you know, he would not have let anything happen. And Or if it did, you know, he'd bring them out and they'd be all right. I just never thought about him being hurt.
There's a big police on the bridge, and I went over there, and I guess I was unruly, and I was peeping over his shoulder, really, and he jerked his paper away from me real fast. He said, "What do you want?" I said, "Nothing." I said, "I see what I was wanting to see," and David's name was 14th on the paper. And it just, you know, I just went into fits then, really. But
a lot of that, it sounds silly, but a lot of it I can't remember. I don't know how long I stood there with the police officer and that sheet of paper. It started raining and snowing, and it was just a terrible day while we were standing there on the bridge. And someone put me into the, my brother, I'm sure, into the patrolman's car. And Junior, my brother, was crying. This is the brother that Roy had gotten the job at Scotia. And I remember asking him, you know, where was he in the mines? You know, here was Junior, and Junior always worked with Zach, and here's Junior out of the mines. And where was Zach at? You know, how could he be missing when Junior was there with me?
We sit there like from 8 o'clock to about 1:30, 2 o'clock. I can't remember exact time. And they came out and told us, you know, and it was a shock. I mean, we thought, you know, we thought at least there'd be one living. I mean, we was wanting all of them to live, but you know, it was like the. The nurses came out, wanted to give us shots or give us pills, you know, to prepare us, I guess, you know, kindly dope us up. And I would refuse. I'd say, no way, I didn't want them, you know, I didn't want no pills. So then after the nurses did what they should done or was trying to do, the preacher came in. And then here all the senators came in, Tim Lee Carter and some more guys came in. And the preacher said, he said, "May we have your attention?" You know. And, so it was just like 100 people in that bathhouse or more so. Just like so quiet you could hear a pin drop, you know. And he said, "I'm sorry to say," you know, and that's all it took. I don't believe the man ever finished his sentence. And we went into fits, all of us did. And it wasn't a minute later, he said, "May we have your attention?" And we thought, oh, one's living, you know, just one. I said, "David made it, you know, if anybody made it, it was David." And he said, "We would like to take the bodies and have an autopsy."
An Ordinary Morning, produced by Mary Kazamatsu with technical assistance from Moira Rankin. This is the story of what happened to families who lost husbands, fathers, and sons in the Scotia mine disaster of March 1976.
On the night of March 11th, the mine exploded a second time, killing 11 more men. 8 were coal miners, 3 were federal mine inspectors. The men were part of an exploratory team sent into the mine by officials of the Federal Mine Enforcement and Safety Administration, MESA. Rather than risk a third explosion, MESA ordered the mine sealed, with the bodies of the 11 men still inside. Whole communities were stunned. It was Kentucky's worst mine disaster since the use of illegal explosives had caused the deaths of 38 miners near Hyden, Kentucky, in December of 1970. The Hyden disaster had occurred as officials in Washington, D.C. had barely begun to implement the Federal Coal Mine Safety Act of 1969. Many felt the Scotia disaster, coming over 5 years later, was an outrage. The provisions of the coal mine safety law, if followed, should have prevented the tragedy, and teams of investigators swarmed over the mine, trying to find out what had gone wrong and why. As radio, television, and newspaper accounts focused national attention on Letcher County, Kentucky, the towns of Oven Fork, Benham, Gordon, Partridge, Aola, and Pound mourned their dead, and the families of the victims began to pick up the pieces. For the new widows, one of the hardest things to be done was telling the children. Libby Gibbs remembers leaving her sons, Richie and Tommy, with a neighbor the night their father was killed, and waiting until the next morning to tell them.
You know, I couldn't wake them up and tell them at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. That was just, you know, too much. So my father just took me on home right up the hill from him. And I sit in the window. Came daylight, and I was here. I was watching all the miners, you know, go to work, and that was just killing me. I just, you know, it was just killing me. So Dad said, "No, hon, when I get up, we'll go down and tell the kids." And the kids was 8 and 10 years old then. And I said, "Okay." So I seen my neighbor's husband go to work. So here I slipped out the door, went down there and told my kids. And the baby, I said he was 8 years old. I knelt down. He was laying the head of his mat in the floor. I knelt down. I told him, I said, "Richie." He said, "What?" And I said, "Do you remember about 2 weeks ago, Mama was real sick, and you told me if Mama should die," you know, he came up and told me, he said, "Mama should die, Mommy, don't worry. She would go to heaven." He said, "Yeah, I told you." And I said, "Well, Daddy went to heaven last night."
Of course, the baby, Victoria, being two, had no understanding at all. I mean, you could not sit down with a two-year-old and say there has been an accident and Daddy's not coming home. And I tried to do this with Davis, my five-year-old son, and he would look at me and listen very carefully, and then he'd say, I would ask him, you know, "Do you understand what Mother's telling you? That Daddy is dead." And he would look at me and he said, "I know you told me that, but when he comes back, can we do this or can we go there?" And it took quite a while before he realized that, you know, he didn't know what had happened, but he knew that, you know, Daddy wasn't coming home. You know, death, there was no, he had nothing to relate death to. You know, we had never even lost an animal before. And he was a very mixed up little boy. Now, Victoria would hear a car coming up the driveway and her little fat legs would run for the door. But when Daddy didn't come through it, you know, she would do her da-da-da bit, you know. And eventually she stopped running for the door.
As the days stretched into weeks and months, the women found some of their greatest comfort and strongest support in each other.
We couldn't have done it without each other. I don't know, it seemed like us 15 ladies was good for each other. I mean, we was... seemed like if it was nice, we couldn't pick out friends, you know, but we was good for each other, helped us, you know. And like I had a problem, I would call Debbie, you know, or Jenny, you know, and Jenny and Debbie was the same way. You know, if they wanted to talk to me about something, they just call and cry out the way, you know. I said, "Well, okay," you know, but we was real close. We are real close.
Most of the women did not even know each other while their husbands were living. They met, some of them for the first time, in the Scotia bathhouse, as they waited into the night for news of their husband's fate. That vigil bound them together, and a few weeks after the funerals were over, the women arranged to meet again. The meeting took place in a local church. As they talked and cried together, the women remembered things their husbands had told them about the mine. The men hadn't talked a lot about their work, or about safety in the mines, but the women remembered being worried by what they had said. And looking back, some things seemed especially significant.
There was no training, and he was concerned. My brother, when he turned 18, Roy got him a job at Scotia. And they had no formal training at Scotia because he told him, like the night before, the next day he was to go to work, he told him what to do in the mines, what not to do, and, you know, to stay pretty close to him until he knew what was going on in there.
Did you talk with your husband about the possibility that he might be injured or killed?
There was a rock fall a couple of months before the explosion at Scotia. And from his description, a whole section of the mines had fallen in, and they'd lost a lot of equipment in there, but he had gotten out, and his men, he was a crew boss, sort of a, the men looked up to him, but he was not in an official supervisory position at Scotia. And they'd called him into the office and just raised hell because the equipment was in there. And they asked him, you know, couldn't he hold it up until the equipment got out? And said he told him, hell no. You know, I couldn't hold it up. We got our asses out of there while we could get them out. And I talked with him that night about leaving Scotia and going to Lynch. And, you know, the union mines, safety regulations, and, you know, if the bosses jumped you, you at least had the union to back you up. You know, you're more important than a piece of equipment, no matter what it cost. And he would not discuss it because at the time we needed the money that he could earn at Scotia, and he had every intention of making it while he was young, and that's what he was doing.
In early April of 1976, the Interior Department began hearings on the disaster. By that time, the tragedy had moved out of the headlines of most of the nation's newspapers. But when the hearings opened in Whitesburg, Kentucky, the Letcher County Courthouse was packed with families and friends of the 26 victims, and with other miners who worked at Scotia. They listened as company officials, supervisors, and rank-and-file miners described the events of March 9th and 11th. What they heard shocked them. The explosion had been caused by a spark igniting a pocket of methane gas. By law, coal operators are supposed to provide enough ventilation in their mines to flush out methane before it can build up to explosive concentrations. The working sections are required to be checked for methane at regular intervals. Obviously, the ventilation system hadn't been strong enough to prevent a methane buildup at Scotia. The panel of investigators wanted to know whether the section had been checked for methane before the work shift began. Geraldine McKnight remembers listening as the fire boss, whose job it was to check, admitted he hadn't done so.
So he did admit that he had not fire-bossed the mines, but the papers, the books had been signed that he had. And that was the first witness and the first line of questioning, and I thought, my God.
As the hearings continued, testimony pointed to a history of ventilation problems and citations for safety violations. Rank-and-file miners testified they hadn't been trained for emergencies. They didn't know the location of escape routes or how to use the self-rescuers, which were designed to filter out carbon monoxide gas in the event of an explosion or fire. For the families of the first 15 victims, these hearings marked an emotional turning point.
I guess that's really when I began getting angry. Up until that time, you know, hurt and pain and you know, what do I do now? And all these feelings were there, but the anger against Blue Diamond began the day of the hearings, and it began against Blue Diamond and Scotia and the people who worked at Scotia, the supervisors and the people who worked alongside of him. But during the times that I testified, and I'm a very self-conscious person, but I was so angry that I wasn't nervous or self-conscious. I was angry, and that's why I testified in Whitesburg, and that's why I would have gone to Washington if I'd had to hitchhike, for lack of a better way to get there.
The anger that Geraldine, Libby, and the other women felt toward Scotia Coal Company and its owner, Blue Diamond Coal Company, led to talk about a lawsuit, but finding a lawyer to handle their case seemed difficult. Many lawyers in Appalachia are on retainer to coal operators, and some of the women were worried that a local lawyer wouldn't be able to represent the interests of 15 women who wanted to sue a coal company. With help from the Council of the Southern Mountains, an Appalachian activist organization, and the Washington, D.C.-based Center for Law and Social Policy, the women were eventually put in touch with Attorney Gerald Stern. Stern had won a $13.5 million settlement for survivors of the Buffalo Creek disaster. That tragedy had occurred when a coal company dam burst, flooding Buffalo Creek Valley in West Virginia. A few months after the Scotia disaster, Stern agreed to go to Kentucky and meet with the women. Libby Gibbs remembers he wasn't very optimistic.
We all decided, well, we're going to sue somebody. We're going to, you know, get even with somebody if we can. You know, we want to find out what happened. And Gerald came down and talked to us about it. He said, ladies, I don't think you have a chance. And here I said, I asked dumb questions. You know, he said, you can't sue Scotia Coal Company, you know. And I said, well, why not? And he said, we just can't, you know, I don't think you can.
I knew from my experience in West Virginia that the workman's compensation statutes have historically immunized the employer from any lawsuit for death or injury to any of his own employees. So I knew of this trade-off that had historically been made between the guarantee of some payment, although fairly small, to the injured people or their families in exchange for the immunity to the employer from any further suit. In West Virginia, there had been efforts to get around that by claiming that if the death of a miner was caused by deliberate, reckless intent, almost to the level of murder, then you could sue the employer despite the immunity. We quickly looked into Kentucky law and found that you really couldn't even sue the employer in Kentucky if there was deliberate murder.
And I just received a compensation check. I gave him my compensation check, and he said, do you care I take it with me back to Washington and check it out further? I said, no, if it's going to help me and my kids and the other lady and their kids, take it, you know. And he sent it back about 3 days later, and that's how we got begun.
She showed me a check that she had received and wanted to know what to do about it. She said, here's a workman's compensation check, and can I cash this check, or will I waive my rights? And it was the first time I had seen any of the these workman's compensation checks. What I quickly noticed was that the check had four boxes at the top on the form that it was attached to that indicated four different companies. And the companies were the Blue Diamond Coal Company, the Blue Diamond Mining Company, the Scotia Coal Company, and one other. The box that was checked was the Scotia Coal Company, indicating that her deceased husband had worked for Scotia Coal Company. My immediate reaction was, well, wait a minute, why can't we sue one of these other companies? Blue Diamond Coal Company, I'd heard of Blue Diamond, but didn't recognize at the time that they were two separate companies. So I asked a lawyer who was there, who knew about workman's comp law, if anybody had ever tried to sue a parent corporation. Blue Diamond owned the Scotia Coal Company, and to argue that although Scotia was immune, the parent was not. And he said that it had never come up to his knowledge in Kentucky, and we didn't really know the answer. And it was as a result of that I went back to Washington, and I did some research. It took me less than a day because there were only about six or seven cases that had ever come up in the whole country on that issue. And it looked like there was no law in Kentucky on it. Nobody had ever tried it. And based on that, I did go back and talk with the ladies again and said, well, there might be some possibility here of going around the immunity and actually bringing a suit against the Blue Diamond Coal Company. That doesn't mean that we would win, because you still have to prove that Blue Diamond itself as a separate company did something. But at least we would be in court.
The widow's suit, Boggs versus Blue Diamond, was filed in late October of 1976. It alleged that negligent, careless, and reckless actions on the part of Blue Diamond Coal Company had caused the deaths of the first 15 miners, and it asked for damages of $60 million for their 15 widows and 24 children, two of whom were born after their father's deaths. As the legal machinery was being set in motion, the families of the 11 who perished in the second explosion were nearing the end of their grim vigil. The mine had been unsealed in July, but waist-high water, mud, rock falls, and again methane gas had hampered recovery efforts. Finally, on November 19th, 8 months after they had been entombed, the bodies were brought to the surface.
I had mother eyes, you know. I still have the badge. They had us over on the hill where we look right down and see them as they come out of the mines. And then on across there then, it was the bathhouse where they brought them to. Some old big building there. And when they come out around there, we seen them coming out. Of course, you could hear it coming out, you know, a long time before they did. And I've got how many hours we stood there and waited, watching for them to come out. And they wouldn't even last across that bridge to go over. Nobody's close to him.
Lena Kaiser's son, Kenneth Ray, was one of three federal mine inspectors killed by the March 11th blast. After 4.5 years, the horror of his death and the agony of the long months of waiting are still fresh wounds for his mother. She worries it could happen again. Her youngest son is a coal miner. He works for Scotia Coal Company.
Yeah, he's still working. He's right in the same place that my son got killed. He had an accident himself in July, and he wasn't able to go to work for some time. And he tried it back in the mines. It was low coal, and he couldn't stand it. And he asked them to put him in higher coal, and that's where they put him in the... And it went on, you know, I never caught on to it. Till I guess he'd been working there 2 weeks, and I could hear his wife speaking about things, you know, and I got to questioning and found out he was right in the same place that my son, other son got killed.
Since Ray had been a federal employee, the Kaisers applied to the Office of Federal Employee Compensation for death benefits for loss of personal support.
Every time we send something, they'd write back and want something else. And so it was just, I don't know, different letters from different doctors and Xerox copies of bills, receipts, checks, and over again, same thing.
Billy Fuller of the Council of the Southern Mountains helped Lena Kaiser piece together over 100 pages of documentation to support her claim.
We had to get affidavits from neighbors who knew of Kenneth's support, and that he came every day to visit his mother to see if she needed something to help with the housework and take her to the doctor, grocery, and so forth. Neighbors and people who were not related to them. We also had to furnish affidavits as to how much support she was getting from her other surviving children, which was nil, nothing. She had one son who was employed, but he had a family of his own to support. And also she had one other son who had been disabled, and he has a family of his own too. So those children could not contribute to the support of their parents.
You are listening to part one of a three-part series, Coal Country Women, on From the Vault. For more information, go to fromthevaultradio.org or search our entire collection from the American Women Making History and Culture collection at pacificaradioarchives.org. You can get a copy of this program and the entire series, Coal Country Women, by calling 1-800-735-0230. And now back to part one, Coal Country Women, from 1976.
After months of bureaucratic delays, pressure from Congressmember John L. Dent, who chaired the House Subcommittee on Labor Standards, finally prompted a response. 2.5 years after their son's death, the Kaisers were awarded monthly compensation payments of $167. Families of other victims of the second explosion were involved in separate legal actions. Their cases were complicated by the government's role in the disaster. The Federal Mine Enforcement and Safety Administration, MESA, had taken control of the Scotia mine after the first explosion. The men killed on March 11th had been sent underground by MESA officials. Families of the first 15 miners killed were facing other problems. The decision to sue Blue Diamond had thrust the women into the public spotlight in a new way. They were challenging the traditional order of things in Appalachia. Friends and neighbors who had supported them in the early days of their loss were now pressuring them to give up. Other miners had gone back to work at Scotia, and their family's survival depended on company paychecks.
There was, you know, the remarks made, you know, you can't fight the coal company. You know, you're running up against a brick wall. You're making yourself sick for nothing. You know, talk to them. Get what you can and, you know, stay home and raise your children and be a good mother to the kids and forget all this. You know, it's not doing you any good. You're making enemies and you were supposed to take what you could get and stay home and be a nice little widow. It was as though, you know, it's happened. We can't change that. So stop making waves. You know, it's not going to bring Roy back. And no good will ever come out of it. And you're going to get other people for it. And there was lots of anti-feeling against the whole thing. It was as though, you know, Roy was a great guy while he was alive, but, you know, it happened. He was no longer there, so, you know, face that and forget it. And I just felt like, you know, the chances of her doing anything was very slim, and I knew that. But I also knew that, you know, I would never be able to explain to the children someday, you know, what had happened, especially with the Whitesburg hearings being a matter of public record. They would read those someday, and they would look at me and say, well, what did you do? And when that day comes, I expect to be able to tell them that I filed as well as I could fight them, and that we accomplished what we could accomplish, but we didn't take what happened as an accident, and you know that I never forgot their father.
The pressures mounted as the first trial date approached. Lawyers for both sides subpoenaed witnesses and recorded their statements in depositions. For many of the widows, the pretrial depositions were a sad time.
Blue Diamond, I guess you would call, subpoenaed us before we went to Pikeville. They called each of the ladies into a little room and asked us a lot of questions. Personal questions like, was we dating? And, I don't know what else. You know, millions of questions. I can't think what it was. But one question really got to me. They kept on saying, when your husband died, when your husband this, you know. But they seemed like every other question had something about David's dying. And I got to the point, I could not take it. And they said, they got through and they said, you can go now. I said, no, sir, I'm not a going. And they said, you can go, Miss Gibbs. I said, no. I said, David did not die. David was killed. And Rosha killed David. And I said, that's hard to take, but that's what happened.
In September of 1977, the trial opened in U.S. District Court in Pikeville, Kentucky. The judge was H. David Hermansdorfer, who had presided over numerous coal cases since coming to the federal bench in 1972. Heading Blue Diamond's legal team was former Kentucky Governor Burt Combs. Combs had successfully defended the Finley brothers, coal operators, in lawsuits stemming from the Hyden disaster 7 years earlier. Hermansdorfer had also been the judge in that trial. The women lost their first round in Hermansdorfer's court.
It was rough on us. I remember it was in Pikeville. Coming back home, it was about a 3 hours drive. I think I cried all the way, because how was I going to tell my kids that we lost?
Pikeville left me stunned. It took quite a while before it soaked in. And I was standing down in the lobby when Judge Hermansdorfer came downstairs, leaving the courthouse. And I think the hardest thing I ever did in my life was stretch a smile on my face. I'm sure it did not look like a smile. And he went out that door, and I just burst into tears, and I was so hurt. You know, it just seemed to be so unfair.
It was a devastating time for the ladies and for us as lawyers, or I guess even more so as friends of these people, because it was not even what they had hoped for. They wanted their day in court. I don't think they would have even minded if they'd had their day in court and lost. What they minded was they had their day in court and no decision was really given them. The judge ruled that they had no right to be suing the Blue Diamond Coal Company, that they were immune from suit under the same on the same basis as was the Scotia Company. That kind of legal decision could have been given at any time. Instead, the decision did not come down until after we had presented our entire case on the merits to the jury over a 3-day trial, during which the women had to hear some very, very sad information about their husbands, much of which was new to them. They learned of the fact which men lived, how long they lived, what was the physical condition of the bodies of the men. They suffered tremendously through the 3-day jury trial. That was not necessary. The judge was going to rule against us. That could have been done prior to hearing the merits of the case. On the other hand, as I was able to reflect on it as time went on, it was the best way they could have lost, because the record that went up to the Court of Appeals contained not just the sterile legal issue of whether a parent is immune from suit for a subsidiary's wrongs, but whether, with all the facts that we demonstrated of Blue Diamond negligence and liability and recklessness and carelessness, whether with all that, not just a sterile legal question, but those facts, whether a Court of Appeals would say you can't sue. So I, although I felt very, very devastated by the loss, in retrospect, it was the best way to lose. And I think it helped to persuade the Court of Appeals that we really ought to have a chance at proving that Blue Diamond did something wrong.
The U.S. Court of Appeals in Cincinnati ruled in favor of the Scotia families.
It was a narrow victory even then. The Court of Appeals ruled with us 2-1. It was very close. But the decision was that Blue Diamond could be sued. If we could prove that Blue Diamond, as a separate company, did something wrong, we could recover. From then on, it was just a question of time.
In October of 1979, the U.S. Supreme Court refused Blue Diamond an appeal on the immunity question, and the Scotia case was finally sent back to Kentucky for a retrial. Amid newspaper reports of his own coal holdings, Judge Hermansdorfer quickly withdrew from the case, and Boggs v. Blue Diamond was reassigned to Judge William Bertelsmann. The case was set to go to trial on August 18, 1980, in Frankfort, Kentucky.
Realistic, we were faced with going back to trial, and we had what everyone felt to be a fair judge, which is all that we have. We did not want one in sympathy to us or sympathy to Blue Diamond. We wanted a fair person, and we all felt that he was. And the settlement talks, he said, you know, you must realize that you can go to court, and those of you with small children, you can lose everything. You could have fought all this time and lose what future for your children that very possibly you could win for your children. He said, you know, there's a possibility of securing a good future for them going to court, or there's a possibility of losing and coming out with nothing.
In mid-August, the families and the Blue Diamond Coal Company reached an out-of-court settlement for $5.9 million. The papers were signed just 2 days before the new trial was scheduled to begin. According to attorney Gerald Stern, the unity of the 15 families throughout the protracted legal battle was a major factor in their success.
The explosion was in March, and the suit was filed near the end of that year. I think it had a great power that all 15 of the families stuck together before the suit and filed it as one entity. This is the kind of suit that, up against a well-financed coal company, it could not be handled by one or two or three women. The expenses mounted rapidly. We had to go to a jury trial, lose, go to the Court of Appeals, go to the Supreme Court to offset their effort at certiorari, go back for another trial. One or two or three women trying to find a law firm that could stick with them that long would have been most difficult. In fact, it was most difficult to have us stick with them for 15 women. We had a lot of difficult nights recognizing the amount of the expenses as they built up. So I think that the banding together made the lawsuit possible. I don't think it could have even been filed if they weren't all together. Certainly could not have been maintained for the 4 years it took before they finally won.
The women worked out their own formula for dividing the $5.9 million settlement. Half of it was set aside for the 24 children. The remainder was divided into lump sum payments, monthly allotments, annuities, and trust funds.
Our main purpose, I believe, is all of this, is to get our kids a good education. But most so, maybe we might show the other coal companies what happened, and maybe it might be a little safer for the other coal miners. Because if it wasn't for coal miners, where would we be, you know?
Hopefully, the various pressures of lawsuits that you can't do what you used to do in the coal fields, which is to pay the widows a pittance and go on mining the way you always have. At least they know there'll be pressures to bring the companies to the court of justice and to make them pay an appropriate amount. Hopefully that will have some effect. There has been an editorial in the Lexington, Kentucky paper after this settlement saying that the settlement is a victory for all coal miners in terms of safety, that the women did accomplish one of their major goals, which was to say to all coal companies, you better operate safely or there's going to be 15 women coming after you to make you pay.
Touching the company's pocketbook that way may well be the only thing that will cause them to improve conditions in their mines.
Sister Eileen Harrington, a member of the Kentucky-based order, the Sisters of Loretto, works with the coal company monitoring project.
It may just take the Scotia widows and their strength and determination in setting this precedent, and perhaps other survivors of future explosions, and I'm sure that there will be more explosions. It may take those kinds of legal actions to convince the companies that they're going to have to pay a lot for continuing to let people die in their mines.
Largely because of what was learned in hearings on the Scotia disaster, Congress passed amendments to strengthen the federal mine safety law. The Mine Safety and Health Act of 1977 took effect on March 9, 1978. One of the changes under the law was the transfer of federal enforcement authority from the Interior Department to the Department of Labor. To reflect a new emphasis on safety, the name of the agency was also changed to the Mine Safety and Health Administration. Its enforcement powers were strengthened, and the miners themselves were given increased protection under the law. They could call in federal inspectors, and they could walk out of unsafe mines. For the first time, federal standards were set requiring special training for new miners. Companies were also required to give all miners regular safety training. The new law addresses many of the conditions which Congress felt had contributed to the Scotia disaster. But in the coal fields of Appalachia, many of the same problems persist.
The law requires that miners with no underground mining experience must receive at least 40 hours of training if they are going to work underground, and that has to include about 8 hours of training in the actual work environment, as well as instruction away from the mine in a whole bunch of different areas, including instruction in their rights under the law. Now, I know that in some places, I've heard from miners that the safety directors, the people who are in charge of running the safety training program, don't know anything about safety either. I've talked with people who are working in mines who feel totally unprepared in terms of being familiar with escape routes. I think some companies, you know, have made an honest effort to improve their safety training, and all I can say is that I've talked with miners who are working in places where they still aren't getting adequate training. Now, under the law, those miners can bring a complaint or ask the Mine Health and Safety Administration to come in and investigate. But it's really, I think, unrealistic to expect miners en masse to now begin using the self-help remedies that are available under the law. Hopefully, more and more miners will begin using those. But we're talking about a 100-year tradition of miners being intimidated and fired when they try to make a stink about their workplace being unsafe. So I think that, you know, what we need to require is the most affirmative action we can imagine on the part of corporations to correct the problems of safety training as well as the others. We need to expect that federal inspectors will be very aggressive in checking training programs. We just can't expect miners to all of a sudden say, we've got a law here that says we can do this, and take upon themselves the primary responsibility for protecting the safety of their workplace.
As Harrington suggests, a tradition of intimidation and the workers' fear to use the law's self-help protections are only part of the problem. Attorney Gerald Stern sees coal companies continuing to emphasize production over safety.
The people who have risen to the top in some of these companies are the people who push production, who can get more production out of the coal mines. And nobody's ever given a pin and awarded a promotion for operating the safest. He's given his promotion for producing the most coal. So that concept is what has been the problem. And I don't know that you can point to specific dollars that would have made a change. It's the concept. It's how you get ahead in the coal industry.
Unless that concept changes, can any safety law make a difference?
The laws that they have, if they were enforced properly, I think would make the world a difference.
Geraldine McKnight.
The trips to Washington was just mind-boggling. You know, it seems to be so clear that you should be able to say, well, this is the law, so therefore it must be done this way. And by rights, that's the way it should be done. But it isn't. And each time it isn't, they have all these hundreds and hundreds of pages of reports as to why it wasn't, or whose fault it was, or whose fault it wasn't. But no one, I'm really convinced that no one is going to be strong enough or to take such a strong stand. You know, all the widows in the world can march on Washington, and you're just going to be another bunch of women, and tomorrow you'll be gone.
Less than 2 weeks before this interview took place, a methane gas explosion killed 5 miners at a Westmoreland Coal Company mine near Robinson, West Virginia. 4.5 years had passed since the Scotia disaster.
You know, they have these computers and these violations, these records were going to be pulled out of the computer and pinpoint which mines was always in violation of the safety laws, and it was those mines that they were going to come down on hard with their blitz inspections and the fines that they were going to pay and, just really close ranks and let them have it. And in the mines over here in Robinson, West Virginia, with their history of violations. See, you know, the hearings ended, and so did all the fantastic things that they were going to do, all the improvements that they were going to make. You know, it happened again, and it could have been a large number of men. It could have been another 15 or 38 or whatever in that mines in West Virginia. It would have still happened. Yeah, the coal miners are such a small part. They're so far down on the scales that, you know, unless you're some huge multi-million dollar of power, you know, with the ability to get the world's attention or to shake up a few people, you're really not going to be heard very loudly or you're not going to be listened to very well.
Pick up a newspaper anywhere in the coal-producing region of Appalachia. Almost every week, you read of deaths or disabling injuries in coal-related accidents. One miner electrocuted when he touched an unshielded cable. Another injured when the brakes on a shuttle car failed. Two killed in a roof fall. Attorney Gerald Stern believes the Scotia case could not have been won had not all 15 women been united from the start in the pursuit of their goal and in their support of each other. What, then, of the families who lose loved ones in these isolated, individual coalfield tragedies? Sister Eileen Harrington.
I don't know what they're left with. First of all, you know, I think about the situation of a family whose main income earner has perhaps been permanently disabled or killed in a mine. How do they even begin going about trying to get the damages that they're due when most of the lawyers in the region are either working for coal operators or are intimidated when it seems to be the case that oftentimes local judges are somehow connected personally with the coal industry. It's not to say that all judges and all lawyers in Appalachia are, you know, in bed with the coal operators, but apparently lots of them are. The cost of, you know, of getting an attorney is pretty staggering. There are some, you know, good legal services corporation-related agencies in Appalachia, but sometimes, you know, they're forbidden from doing certain things by the Congress or other federal bodies that really don't want federal money being spent for serious social change in Appalachia. At least that's my interpretation. So I really don't know what to say about, you know, the one miner who's killed here and the other miner who's disabled there. I think that the Scotia widows have made the legal precedent so that their chances are better of recovering. But again, it gets down to, you know, the question of at what price does a person lose her or his ability to earn a living for the rest of their lives? I mean, what is just compensation for that? You know, what's just compensation for losing your spouse or your father or your mother in a mining accident?
Before this happened, did you worry every day or did you think about the possibilities? Was it on your mind a lot?
Of course. I mean, like every morning, I gave Dave a kiss. I said, be careful. I love you, you know. That was every morning, 6:30 routine, you know. I did that. I had anybody who sends their husband off to the job, I believe, and if they really care, no matter what the job was, they had the fear. But I had a great fear because, you know, I knew certain parts of that mine was gassy. And I had a fear always in the back of my mind that something was going, you know, might happen. But I was like every woman whose husband worked up there. It couldn't happen to mine. So I had a fear.
The Scotia tragedy is a memory. 15 young widows challenged a powerful coal company and won. In the process, they were transformed from housewives into a collective symbol of the need for improved workplace safety. Some testified in hearings and helped government investigators track down other witnesses. They were the targets of gossip and the subjects of newspaper articles. Two of the women died before the case could be settled. Several have remarried. Four have moved away from the towns where they lived when it all began.
Did you see him going? It was early this morning. He passed by these houses on his way to the coal. He was tall, he was slender, and his dark eyes so tender.
The night before the March the 8th, me and David was sitting out on the porch. And He told me, he said, if that mine ever blows, I hope to God I'm not in it.
I was feeding the children. Ben Mosley came running to bring us the news. Number 8 is off.
But he knew. Junior knew that that's where he was and that he was dead. That there would have been no way of surviving an explosion that bad.
So I picked up the baby and I left all the others to comfort each other and pray for our own. There is Timmy 14 and
I don't want my kids to ever go into coal mines. And if I have anything to do with it, they won't go to my coal mines. That's why I'm trying to get them a good education. When it's time to go to college, they will go to college. But coal mines frightens me to death.
I give them good learning, the best could be found. So when they grow up, they'd be checkers and weighers. And not spend their time drilling in the dark.
Well, I say I hope they have that mind safely. The same thing won't happen again.
And that does it for this week's From the Vault. For a copy of this program or programs in this series, visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org or call us toll-free in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres, executive producer Brian DeShazer. We thank our partners, collaborators, and grant funders, the American Archive of Public Broadcasting, the Pop-Up Archive, the Internet Archive, UC Berkeley, and the NHPRC at the National Archives. I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening and keeping our history alive.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in court.